What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio. Special Operations Military News and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to Soft Rep Radio. Soft Rep Radio, on time, on target. We're here with the best guests and topics that, takes care of everything, either in the military, law enforcement, or current affairs that's going on outside our own borders as well as within. Today, we have a great guest lined up for us. Jeff Nice is about a 30-year member of the Montgomery County SWAT team. And when you talk about people with practical experience, Jeff's probably been on about 3,000 to 4,000 raids with the SWAT unit. He was involved with the DC sniper takedown, the Discovery Building suicide bomber, hostage rescue. This is a guy that's been there. He's done that. He's seen it all. He's also a survivor of a couple of different diseases that were told to him that he was terminal about 8 to 10 years ago. So when you're talking about people that have the right attitude and hard charges, this actually is describes our guest to a T. He just came up with the book Failure Is Not an Option, and he talks about his career in there, and we're going to welcome him to the podcast. Jeff, thanks for taking the time with us this morning. We really appreciate it.
Great to be here.
Yeah, so for the listeners, and just, you don't have to get in too much detail, just basic overview of how you ended up becoming a police officer, what what pushed you to that type of career, and then talk a little bit about your career and how you came to be in SWAT.
As a kid growing up, I always had great admiration for police and the military. And as a teenager, my next door neighbor was a Montgomery County police officer. And he very much influenced my decision to go into law enforcement. And then from there, I guess to kind of satisfy on some small end, the interest I had in the military, I went into SWAT because of the application of tactics and things of that nature as it relates to the military. Certainly nothing compared to what the military does, but just on a small scale, I could get a taste of it.
Yeah, and what year did you join the police department?
1981, I retired in 2014.
So 33 years, and almost all of that was as a member of the Montgomery County SWAT team, wasn't it?
Correct. I spent 30 years in SWAT as an operator, team leader, and eventually a commander.
That's impressive. You know, I was reading your book. Was it like 3,000 to 4,000 raids you've been on? I mean, I'm sure you lost track, but is that number correct?
Yeah, best guess was about 4,500 raids and barricades.
That's amazing that there's that much going on. Of course, up in, you know, that Montgomery County, you know, for our listeners who aren't familiar with that, Montgomery County, Maryland borders Washington, D.C. It's right over the D.C. line, and it's a very, I mean, that whole area from Washington, D.C. all the way to Baltimore is pretty heavily populated. There's a lot of stuff obviously going on there, and we're going to get into that. But what was your initial training like when, I'm sure the training that you went through for SWAT in 81 has evolved, and I'm sure they're doing more of it today, but what was that like initially entered?
No doubt has evolved. Like when I first got into SWAT, it was in 84. And back then, what you would do is once you were selected, you were sent to other schools by other outside agencies to continue your training. You know, and over the course of time, I probably attended 50 schools from outside agencies geared towards breaching, sniper craft, hostage rescue, and CQB, and a host of other tactics. But again, you're constantly evolving and going to these new schools as time evolved.
Yeah, being so close to DD, did you guys utilize the FBI Academy at all? I mean, it's not that far from where you're located.
We had a great relationship with the FBI HRT, and on occasion we would go down there and they would provide us with training. In fact, one of our former SWAT team members was a team leader down there. And I can't say enough positive things about FBI HRT and what they had done for us. And in addition to the training, on rare occasions, we would get a law enforcement exception to go to a military school. I had the opportunity to go through a Marine Corps sniper school down at Quantico. So it was a mix of things as time progressed.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Did you guys, I know the military gets a little touchy about civilians going to military schools, but where you guys have the mission, I was wondering if you attended any military sniper schools, and obviously the one at Quantico is one of the best in all of the military. They've been doing that for a very long time. And again, it's pretty close to where you guys, as the crow flies, it's really close. Traffic-wise, it might not be so much, but yeah, Quantico's not that far. That answered my next question with that. And I know in the book you talked about you guys had a great relationship with the state police and the FBI SWAT teams. Did you ever do any joint training with any military units?
We don't do joint training, but the one thing I will say is often we had contractors come in and provide training. And some of these contractors, mm-hmm. former military, Tier 1 operators from the Navy side and the Army side. And I have to tell you that I learned a lot from the law enforcement schools, but the Tier 1 guys really open your eyes to tactics and things that you are far beyond the realm of what you're normally exposed to on the law enforcement side.
Yeah, I know you mentioned also in your book that one of the members on your team was a former Navy SEAL that you obviously learned a lot from. I know I'm going to butcher his name, but you may would like to enlighten our readers, our listeners, I should say, about this guy. And, you know, it's a little bit different realm when you go from military to the law enforcement side.
Yeah, without question. I'll share with you his name. The guy was great, Rob Ulisney. And he was the first SEAL that had ever come to our team. And I have to tell you, what he brought was an insight that we had not seen in terms of tactics, CQB, tubular assaults, woodline searches, a host of factors which all came into play on the law enforcement side. So again, that was an eye-opening experience for me back in the day.
Yeah, and you know, when you're talking about the law enforcement side, I'm sure the rules of engagement are much, much stricter when it comes to, you know, what you guys are forced to deal with, because you're dealing with American civilians. Obviously, in the military, the you know, the rules of engagement, as years have gone by, have gotten much stricter. But you know, you talked about that a little bit in the discovery building, and we're going to get into that hostage rescue situation. But you know, it's got to be at times, you know, as an operator, then you were in charge of the team. It's got to be frustrating at times because, you know, with the rules of engagement, it at times, I'm sure, it puts some of your operators at risk.
You make a great point and really kind of touch on something that's kind of been put out in the media lately, which disappoints me greatly, is these no-knock search warrants. They've mm-hmm. come under scrutiny, and yet everybody knows on both the military side and the law enforcement side the importance of the element of surprise. And that's what a no-knock search warrant does. It gives you the element of surprise going against violent criminal offenders who are armed and so forth, versus a no-knock search warrant where you have to knock your announce your presence prior to entry. So there's a lot of things that kind of are coming full circle right now.
Yeah, and you know, again, the people in the media are focusing on a couple of those type of no-knock search warrants that went bad. You know, in the grand scheme of things, probably 99.9% of those don't have that kind of a bad situation the way it ended up. And they're actually, I would probably say, mostly needed because of, again, you're dealing with, those aren't for a guy with traffic tickets. These are guys who are violent criminals, or women who are violent criminals and probably are well-armed behind the door. And it's your safety as much as their own.
And you make a great point because, you know, over my career, to do almost 4,500 entries. And we never took fire on any of those entries because we had the element of surprise going on with that no-knock search warrant. And unfortunately, because one search warrant has been called into scrutiny, the millions that were executed successfully and brought violent criminals into custody are now, you know, being thrown to the wayside.
Yeah, and then, you know, I mean, you guys were doing, and again, I'm quoting you from your book, you know, about 200 raids to barricades a year. I mean, you're talking about people with that are doing these almost 2 out of 3 days every year. So it's not like your guy's going to run off half-cocked, you know. And I think that's the perception that a lot of people have, or I should say misconception, that a lot of people have about the police today, that they're all running off half-cocked. And, you know, when you're doing this many operations every year, I just find it hard to believe that so many of them are going to go bad. I mean, otherwise, we'd be hearing about this every single day of the year.
And you make a great point. And to the book, I think Chapter 3, which takes into custody a group of serial bank robbers that were featured on John Walsh's America's Most Wanted. There are 9 of them, to include the leader who was wanted on 2 homicide warrants. And they were armed with AK-47s and body armor. Yet we took them into custody without incident on a no-knock search warrant.
Yeah, and if you could take us back through that operation a little bit, because I thought this was a fascinating part of the book, and actually, until I read the book, I had never heard of this one. I don't know whether I was traveling at the time when it went down, but I never remember hearing anything about this. And then reading the book, how you guys went about it, it was a, I thought it was a fascinating part of the book. And you're talking about guys who were really dangerous. They were very well organized. They were very well armed. And it kind of reminded me of the movie Heat.
And you make a great point. It was back in 2004. Six armed robberies were done in the D.C. region. Of those six, shots were fired inside the bank on two occasions. And on a third occasion, our neighboring jurisdiction, one PG County cruiser took 22 hits from an AK-47. Fortunately, no officers were hurt. Again, nine individuals in this gang and the leader, Miguel Moore, who would do an explosive breach using a water impulse charge on the metal door, metal frame of the apartment the suspects were in. And anytime we do an explosive breach in an apartment, we have a concern about the safety of the other occupants of the other apartments on that floor. So as we are placing the charge on the door, what we do is we tie off with rope those other apartment doors. So that way, when the charge detonates, nobody can come out inadvertently as we're detonating the charge. So ultimately, we use the water impulse charge, effect entry, marshals go in, we go in support, and suspects are taken to custody. They had body armor and they had AK-47s, no shots fired, none of them hurt. So again, once again, this demonstrates how effective a no-knock search warrant can be against violent offenders.
Yeah, that water impulse charge is interesting. That was something I hadn't heard of in a very long time, and you talked about it in the book where it will effectively breach the door, but it doesn't create a whole lot of shrapnel. And one of the suspects was sitting in a chair right by the door and wasn't injured by the blast at all. And those are the kind of things that people need to know about when, you know, when you're talking about these things. You know, we don't have a lot of officers trying to hurt people unnecessarily in these. Well, granted, you know, you're trying to take them down and your safety is paramount. At the same time, you're not trying to hurt them any more than has to be to taking them into custody, and it doesn't you know, affect any of their neighbors. I was interested in how you go about that. In the book, you talked about roping off the neighbors' doors, and I thought that was a very interesting thing, just because you never know when somebody obviously will walk out their door.
And you make a great point in terms of the explosive breaching, and very often people think, oh my gosh, explosives, fragmentation everywhere. And it's not that. It's very calculated science. It's specific in its use, minimum amount of explosives to affect a positive breach. And one suspect was 4 feet from the door when the charge went. He was not hurt. There was a bottle of beer on the table in front of him that was not turned over. And a landline phone was sitting on the edge of a couch. That was not disturbed. So you make the point well that despite the fact that we use explosives, it's a very calculated science. It's surgical with precision and has a very safe application when used right and effectively.
Yeah, and one of the other things you talked about, I thought was interesting about how some suspects use dogs to protect themselves, and how the flashbangs have don't hurt the animal but neutralize them. And you talked about how the dogs were covering their eyes with their paws in one search raid, and I thought that was very interesting. And I think your son actually got to ride in the truck with the dogs after they had obviously been removed and caged.
You make a great point. When I was diagnosed with my diseases, I knew that my time in SWAT was over. So I wasn't sure I was going to make it until I retired 2 years later. So I took my son on my last raid so that he could see what took place. He stayed a safe place back with the tactical medics. But we're hitting a place for guns and drugs. We've been here before. We knew there were pit bulls there. We had a previous occasion where an officer had been bitten scrotum by a pit bull, common ploy used by the drug dealers to slow us down so they'd access their weapons. An effective tool against the dogs, we deploy the flashbang, hand grenade with no fragmentation, just the flash and bang. And what it does is it sends any dog running. So in this instance, we deployed the flashbang, dog went running, and could reach a suspect before they accessed their weapons. And ultimately, the dog secured and turned over to animal control. So it's much safer for everybody using that type of application.
Yeah, and when you talk about dogs, I know you said you had dog officers in the SWAT team. Is it something that I know the military they're going, you know, they're going more and more to you know, trained animals. Is it becoming more of a factor in what the civilian SWAT teams are using?
And you make a great point, because I can tell you that our application of using canine in SWAT, we actually had learned from the military, and we saw how well and effective the military was using dogs in their application of tactics. We have a very, at my time, there was only one canine officer, actually two canine officers and two canine dogs that we used out of the whole group of canines, because it took a very specific type of officer and a specific type of dog to fit into the needs of our SWAT team. But the application I left was they're a bit more integrated and selective in how they use those dogs and so forth. But again, for us, we learned that from the military.
Yeah, and you know, it's amazing how effective those dogs can be. And it's something that I wish we had used a long time ago. I mean, we didn't have any when I was in. That was something that came about, you know, after I was transitioning out. I just think that they're so loyal, they're so smart, and you know, they're definitely in tune with what's going on. I know that, you know, some of the dogs have taken part in some of the biggest military operations, and I was curious if the civilian world was getting into that as well, because I think they're a great resource, and their careers are sometimes as short as the officers, because they get injured as well. But I think, you know, it's amazing how good dogs can make an operation and safer for the people involved, because they're so fast.
Without question. I can't say enough positive things about a well-trained canine and his handler in combination.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the more of the SWAT training now as it's evolved. As somebody who was in it for 30 years, I know the military, our training, we were always evolving it. And now we're getting more into the selection and assessment for our special units, of which in the police department SWAT is. And, you know, we started, obviously, the physical, qualifications and attributes that you have to have, they're uncompromising. I'm sure it's exactly the same in the SWAT units. But we started going, you know, gearing our selection and assessment for those type of guys around more attributes. People had a different mindset of what we were looking for. Are you guys integrating that as well into the civilian SWAT world?
Over time, certainly everything has evolved. And certainly over time, you know, I haven't been there for 30 years. I went through, I'll call it, three generations of SWAT officers, for lack of a better way to say it. And as we got more people from the military side, we kind of evolved more in that type of mindset and moving forward in that direction.
Okay, yeah. Well, I wanted to move forward, and I wanted to talk about this DC sniper. That whole situation that unfolded. I remember that, and then we were talking off air a few minutes before we started the podcast, and I was mentioning to you, it seemed like it was only yesterday, and it's been actually almost 20 years. It's amazing that, you know, so much stuff has gone on in the meantime, but you were right involved exactly in the middle of this thing. And so, explain to our listeners a little bit some of the background, in case some of them have forgotten about this, and how you guys actually ended up catching these two guys.
And what I'll share with you, if I can, is kind of the tactical side, because a lot of people have been sharing the investigative side. And I'll kind of give you a rewind of how things started out. October 3rd of 2002 was the day that really kicked things off in Montgomery County. At 7:30 that morning, a guy, James Sonny Buchanan, was shot mowing the lawn in Rockville near a car dealership. And I can tell you that shooting was very personal for every Montgomery County police officer, because he was a son of one of our retired officers. Soon thereafter, about a half hour later, an individual was shot at a gas station in Aspen Hill. Now, this becomes problematic for us because 400 yards from where he was shot is the Gate of Heaven Cemetery. And at that moment in time, a funeral procession was going to the Gate of Heaven Cemetery to bury one of our officers who had died several days earlier of a heart attack. Now, there was a guy named Commander Drew Tracy who was in charge of 3rd District, and he was my former SWAT sergeant years earlier. There's no connection between the two shootings at this point, but he thought it'd be prudent to defend the cemetery. So we put sniper teams out around the cemetery and uniformed patrol officers along the route in. Tracy also reached out to PG County for a helicopter for overwatch as the procession made it into the cemetery without incident. As all this is occurring, a third shooting occurs 3 miles north up the road. And then a fourth, a half hour after that. All four shootings, one shot, one kill, leading to speculation of a sniper. So, you know, we're working through the day and we work into the night. And then that evening at 9:15, just inside the DC line from Montgomery County, a 72-year-old male was shot and killed. Investigators soon found out there were two shootings from the day before that were related to this incident. So you actually had seven shootings in just over 24 hours, six of which had occurred in Montgomery County. Now, we were really kind of pushed to the limit on the SWAT end because we worked like 36 hours straight. We still needed to be out on the street. So we reached out for additional tactical assets. We always had a very good relationship with the FBI hostage rescue team and the Maryland State Police. So they provided additional tactical operators. What happened was we ended up with, we could field two shifts of 30 working 12-hour days. So at any given moment in time, 24 hours a day, you had 30 tactical operators out on the street. Now, an issue was we were transitioning to a new radio system, and this created potential interagency communication problems. So Commander Tracy, he was in charge of the Montgomery County Task Force. He came up with an idea that I thought was going to be problematic, but actually turned out to be brilliant. What he wanted to do was mix and match the teams. He wanted each vehicle to have one FBI HRT operator, one MSP SWAT guy, and one Montgomery County SWAT guy. The concept was that when the call came in over the radio, all the tactical officers were here at the same time, and he wanted Montgomery County officers driving because we knew the area best and could provide a quick and efficient response. Now, my concern was, we all know tactics of SWAT teams, but no two teams ever do things the same. Well, that concern quickly disappeared because very rapidly we kind of gelled into one team. Now, I was working the night shift, so I was the team leader for Montgomery County SWAT at night. With me was the team leader from FBI HRT, Chuck Pierce, and the team leader from Maryland State, First Class Sergeant Keith Runk. We were the command vehicle. And then there were nine other three-man teams out there just like us. Our role was to coordinate the response of the three agencies. The dozens of calls that would come in each day, you know, whether it be searching a building for a suspect or vehicles, woodline, whatever it may be, and so forth. An issue that came up was command and control. In other words, who would be in charge of a tactical incident if it took place? It was agreed that if an incident occurred in Montgomery County would be the lead agency. It was also decided that if an incident occurred outside of Montgomery County, FBI HRT would be the lead agency. Now, one thing HRT did that was awesome is they federalized both us and the state troopers, meaning that it gave us law enforcement powers outside our normal jurisdiction. So if they chose to, they could take us someplace else on an operation that normally we could not. And that was kind of how we were functioning as these three-man teams. We developed two types of responses, one for an in-county shooting and one for an out-of-county shooting. If a shooting occurred in Montgomery County, our goal was to get one of these three-man teams on scene within 2 to 3 minutes. And their job would be site protection. From where the shooting occurred, we would create a concentric circle with a radius of 3 to 5 miles. Every traffic light in Montgomery County works on an automated system. And we put every one of these traffic lights on flashing red. And what that would do is create a massive traffic jam and slow the egress of any suspects from the scene. Staged in proximity at key points would be our plainclothes units, who would monitor traffic. And they'd be looking for any vehicle wanted in a lookout or suspicious persons and so forth. In proximity to the plainclothes units were our three-man SWAT units. If a vehicle needed to be stopped, then the SWAT would stop and investigate it. And that was kind of our response for an in-county shooting. If a shooting occurred out of the county, we had many that occurred in Virginia, just south of us. Every plainclothes and tactical team had a predetermined location to respond to within the county. We monitored every point of entry back into our county. Once again, looking for any lookout or suspicious vehicle, plainclothes, observing, and if need be, SWAT making the stop. And that's how we kind of monitored our activities within the county and so forth. And then,
Go ahead.
I'm taking a breath and I'll get into how the takedown took place, if you like.
Yeah, I remember reading this in the book, and you know, when you talk about everyone has the same training, but you all operate differently, that's very true. I mean, even in special operations in the military, we've all been through the same training. We all have the exact same, parameters that we use, but each individual team will have their own quirks. And that's, I thought that was brilliant the way it ended up working out, because you guys did actually end up working seamlessly together. And that's not always the easiest thing when you're dealing with different agencies. And the fact that, you know, there was no, as we've seen in different places, interagency jealousy or pettiness, that was all put out the window in regards to, getting the job done with this. And I thought that was a really good point.
And you made a great point right there, because I had heard at the command level, there was some conflict and so forth. Well, I can tell you at a tactical level, I never saw any conflict. Everybody was gung-ho, same page, and supporting everybody. I mean, I felt like we were all one team, even though we were three different agencies at that point.
So take us through the tactical takedown of this and how it all came about.
About 3 weeks into it, investigators had determined who the suspects were. Lee Boyd Malville, age 17, John Allen Muhammad, who had served in the military, Army prior to that. And they're believed to be operating a blue Chevy Caprice with New Jersey tags. Now, in the shootings, all of the victims had been hit with .223 caliber rounds, obviously related to like the AR-15 and the M-16 thereafter and various models. So we knew it was a .223 caliber weapon that they had. The information was broadcast on local radio and TV station. And we did this on the early morning hours of October 24th of 2002. A citizen, Whitney Donahue, who was an appliance repairman who did work out in D.C., was returning to his home in Pennsylvania. What happened is he pulled into a rest stop to catch his breath and a little rest. And when he pulled into the rest stop, he observed the blue Chevy Caprice backed along a wood line. And he had written down the tag number of the suspect vehicle and realized that this was the vehicle police were looking for. Now, the vehicle was backed in a defensive posture along the wood line. You could see all the vehicles that came in from the on-ramp or off-ramp to the rest stop. So he calls Maryland State Police. Maryland State Police isolates the rest stop by shutting down traffic in both directions on the interstate. They also covertly used a tractor trailer to block the off-ramp that returned traffic back to the interstate. This is done out of sight of the snipers. And they contacted the FAA to declare the airspace restricted so that no media helicopters would compromise the operation. So a 19-man SWAT team, or tactical team, is assembled. It's 9 from the FBI hostage rescue team, 5 from Maryland State Police, and 5 from Montgomery County SWAT. Now, the team leaders Chuck Pierce, Keith Runk, and I are transported by helicopter to the forward staging area in Myersville. And the idea is to get the team leaders there ahead of time so that way the operational plan can be in place. Now, because we were outside of Montgomery County, FBI HRT becomes the lead tactical agency. And the overall commander of the incident is Gary Bold, the special agent in charge from the FBI. So, you know, helicopter lands at Myersville. We go over to the McDonald's lot where everybody's staging. And from there, Pierce develops the operational plan. And what we would do is the 19-man team was driven just shy of the rest stop. And we get out of the vehicles. And at that point, we're going to deploy. A concern that we had was the citizen could not determine if anybody was in their vehicle because it had heavy tinted windows. There's a possibility the suspects could be out in the wood line behind the vehicles or in some of the out structures at the site itself. Another concern, obviously, when you think tactics, you know, when there's two, it could be three. When there's three, it could be four. Or is there anybody else involved? So these are all concerns going through our mind. So the game plan was we had sniper teams with night vision gear and thermals go into the wood line behind the suspect vehicle. And what they do is clear that wood line and make sure that there's nobody else in it. And once they had cleared the wood line, they would set up online covering the suspect vehicle and the other out structures. Simultaneous to their deployment, a perimeter team was deployed. There's a small wooded area on the left flank of the rest stop that separated the interstate from the rest stop itself. So a perimeter team went into this position. So in essence, what you had was a tactical L. You had the online, the sniper teams behind the suspect vehicle, covering the lot and so forth. And to the left of them along that left flank was the perimeter team. Again, between the two in combination had a tactical L, so the whole area was covered with overlapping, interlocking fields of fire. And by having the sniper teams in place and clearing that wood line, what that did is clear a path for the assault team to the vehicle. We would approach the vehicle from behind with the trunk facing us. There were six of us on the assault team, four from FBI HRT, Keith Runk from Maryland State Police, and myself from Montgomery County. And the game plan was HRT would handle the breach and extraction. Keith Runk and I would post as designated shooters on the trunk, covering the inside of the vehicle. So you basically would have two elements, a left side element and a right side element. It was thought that the suspects would probably have one guy as the lookout in the driver's seat and maybe somebody else in the back seat. So we come up behind him through the woods, and the woods start to thin. We're able to get with about 20 yards of the suspect vehicle. And from here, we break into our two elements, left and right side. Pierce, the HRT leader, gives us the countdown with his fingers, 3, 2, 1, and we move. I post on the left side of the trunk. My field of fire is everything on the interior of the vehicle on the left side. Simultaneous to me posting, two HRT guys move forward and breach and extract Malvo, who had fallen asleep in the driver's seat. He's quickly extracted and placed down on the left side in the parking lot. Hands suddenly come up right in front of me in the back seat, and that's Muhammad in the back seat. Simultaneous to our action on the left side, the right side element had moved. Keith Runk had posted as a shooter on the right side of the vehicle, covering the right interior of the vehicle. And two HRT operators breached and extracted Muhammad out of the right rear passenger seat. So at this point, I'm looking. I take about 3 steps back because both suspects are in custody. I'm covering the trunk. I call to Runk to grab the tree keys from the ignition. He quickly grabs the keys, comes back, drops to a knee. I give him a nod. He pops the trunk open. HRT operator had also picked up coverage on the trunk. He calls clear, I call clear. So at this point, both suspects are down, left and right. The trunk is clear. I would say it's probably 30 to 45 seconds total from the time we left the wood line, reached extraction of both suspects, and cleared the trunk. Now, one thing kind of struck me as I was looking at the trunk. The car was pretty beat up in appearance. I noticed this hole above the license plate. And it was almost consistent with the overall damage associated with the car, all beat up. And I didn't recognize it for what it was. One of the HRT operators, landman standing next to me, he points out that there's a sock in this hole for camouflaging it. He recognized it for what it was. I did not. It was a shooting port. The snipers were using the trunk as a sniper hide, and a small hole was cut out where they were taking their shots from. Now, Malvin and Muhammad are taken into custody, and we go back to the academy to brief the morning team that's coming on. And when we get to the academy, we find out that the evidence technicians, when they search the car, behind the cushions in the back seat, they pulled down and found a Bushmaster 223 caliber rifle that was bungeed in place. Had a loaded magazine and one in the chamber at that time. So when I'm back at the academy, there's something I really want to talk to Pierce about, the HRT team leader. He had done a great job on the operation. I thanked him for keeping Montgomery County SWAT involved and MSP involved. And the reason I thanked him is because HRT had sufficient numbers. If they wanted, they could have handled this incident themselves. But it was very personal for everybody in Montgomery County. Once again, the first victim on October 3rd was the son of one of our retired officers. It affected our ability to bury one of our own in peace at the Gate of Heaven Cemetery. And Montgomery County had suffered the most casualties. Of the 10 killed, 6 were in Montgomery County. Ultimately, the snipers would be tied to 23 shootings across the country. Muhammad was convicted and sentenced to death by lethal injection November of 2009. And Malvo is currently serving consecutive life sentences. That's kind of the story behind it from the tackle side.
While you're catching your breath there, let me just pause for a moment and read something from one of our sponsors real quickly, and because we'll get back to that in just a second. But have you ever had a time when you search for something online and you didn't want others knowing about it? I know most of you are probably thinking, well, you could just use incognito mode. But let me tell you something, incognito mode doesn't hide your activity. It doesn't matter what mode you use or how many times you clear your browsing history. Your internet service provider can see every single website you've ever visited. That's why when we're at home, we never go online without using ExpressVPN. It doesn't matter if you get your internet from Verizon, Comcast, Charter, any of the other local ISP offerings. ISPs in the U.S. can legally sell your information to ad companies. ExpressVPN is an app that reroutes your internet connections through their secure service so your ISP can't see the sites that you visit. ExpressVPN also keeps all your information secure by encrypting 100% of your data with the most powerful encryption available. Most of the time, you won't even realize you have ExpressVPN on. It runs seamlessly in the background and is very, very easy to use. All you have to do is tap one button and you're protected. ExpressVPN is available on all your devices, phones, computers, even your smart TV. So there's no excuse for you not using it. Protect your online activity with the VPN rated number one by CNET and Wired. Visit our exclusive link, expressvpn.com/softrep, and you can get an extra 3 months free on a one-year package. That's expressvpn.com/softrep. Check out expressvpn.com/softrep to learn even more. So we're going to come back to our podcast right now. We're talking with Jeff Nice. We're talking about the DC snipers. He just talks through the tactical part of the operation where the FBI, HRT, and his own people took down these two guys. Was there one thing I forgot to ask, and I didn't mention it in the book. I know it was like 3 o'clock in the morning at this rest area. Was there a lot of other people, like just people who were traveling, through the Maryland Turnpike on the road at that time, or was the rest area pretty empty at that point?
It was pretty empty. I think it was one other vehicle at that time, and again, Maryland State Police had quickly shut down the interstate so nobody could get to the rest area.
Yeah, because, that wouldn't have been a good time to be walking your dog along the wood line. you're on a trip and you know, talk about bad timing if you're walking your dog in the wood line when all that's going down. But the other thing that I found interesting in your book, we talked about that slot that the snipers were using to fire from the trunk, and they had their Bushmaster rifle, you know, in the back. It was a technique that the IRA used, and you guys found that out afterwards, I would imagine, from the FBI. That's where they got that from, by searching the internet and coming across that?
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Waiting on a tax return? Hopefully it ends up in your hands. Fraudulent tax returns due to identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. LifeLock monitors and alerts you to identity threats you may miss on your own, even if you're careful with your personal information. And if you do become the victim of tax-related identity fraud, LifeLock has U.S.-based restoration specialists ready to help solve identity theft issues on your behalf. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. Why wait for your tax refund in vain? Help protect your information immediately with LifeLock. Go to LifeLock.com/news and save up to 25% your first year. That's 25% off at LifeLock.com/news. Identity theft protection starts here.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit Spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
It was inferred that they had copied it from the IRA, and that came from one of the investigators thereafter, but so I'm not really sure. One thing is that you made a good point. On occasion here, I may appear to be a little out of breath, and that's just relative to my medical condition, amyloidosis, cardiac amyloidosis. No worries, it's just kind of the nature of the new norm, if you will.
No, not a problem at all for us. I just, I know I was asking you to talk us through there, and I didn't want you to get, you know, out of breath doing so. That's why, I was just trying to give you a little bit of a breather there. But
I'll take it again.
If you ever need to take a break for a second, just say the word, and we'll pause there. But I wanted to also talk about the Discovery Building suicide bomber case. And again, you were right in the middle of it. And this happened, you know, I believe that was the Discovery Building That's in Rockville, isn't it? Or is that?
It's actually back in Silver Spring. It was September 1st.
Oh, Silver Spring. Okay.
Yeah. 2010. It's 1 mile north of DC Line in Silver Spring and Business District.
Yeah. And again, for some of our listeners who might not be remembering all of that, if you could talk us through a little bit of the background, how it started, and then we'll go from there.
Okay. One thing I'd like to talk about prior to, because it was big in terms of us having a successful resolution, was some training we had done prior to this incident. Prior to this incident, we had developed what we called our Code Red counter-terror teams, and they were to help us respond to potential post-9/11 type incidents. And what we did is we took 100 personnel in the police department, and we trained them in a variety of tactics. 2 months prior to discovery was the culmination of this training. And we'd done a bunch of scenarios. Now, most scenarios were geared towards active shooter and IEDs. But just by chance, one scenario we did was for a suicide bomber with hostages. Just by chance, again, the scenario when we did it in a building of similar size and design of Discovery. And just by chance, one more time, we did the scenario we did in the lobby of the building. As Discovery played out, it occurred in the lobby. Another important thing is that during this training, we integrated our bomb techs. Bomb techs usually are on the police side, but Montgomery County, they're actually on the fire rescue side, where they are bomb techs and fire marshals. I guess the point I'm making is that because we had Code Red teams in place, because we had integrated with our bomb techs, and because we had trained for an identical scenario 2 months prior, this provided huge dividends as we roll into this incident.
Yeah, and I remember from reading in the book, when you talked about the Code Red emergency response team, you said that the, and again, it doesn't seem like that long ago, but it was November 2008, the terrorist attack in Mumbai,
yes.
India. Yeah. And you guys recognized that as a, you know, SWAT team in a large, you know, population area, that you guys weren't prepared for something of that kind of magnitude. And again, I mean, I think of Mumbai, and it doesn't seem like that long ago, and we're talking 12 years, but again, something that played out somewhere else in the world, it drove the fact that you guys prepared for that, and it just so happened that the timing was right because your training right as this situation unfolded.
And one thing that was kind of a little crazy early on is an off-duty officer named Ed Payton. He did a great job. He responded off-duty and came to Discovery to help isolate the suspect. Initially, what we had was an individual who was in the lobby, fired shots, took hostages, and had a PBID on his person. Ed Payton, off-duty, announces to the dispatcher that he's off-duty, plain clothes, yellow police band on his left shoulder with a Benelli shotgun, goes in to help contain the suspect because he was familiar with the Discovery building. Unfortunately, Ed Payton was misidentified by a person high up in that building as a second gunman armed with a machine gun in the garden area of Discovery. So going back to what you said about Mumbai, I sort of think of similarities between Mumbai and what was happening here. In Mumbai, you had the Taj Mahal motel overtaken. Here you have Discovery Building, the world's number one largest nonfiction media outlet being taken over. In Mumbai, you had active shooters on the railway platform, where our officer was misidentified as a gunman with a machine gun. 200 yards away was a railway platform. So once again, early on, there were some factors thinking that this might have been a multi-site attack, so we activated our Code Red teams as part of this response as well.
Yeah, and you talk about Payton quite extensively in the book. And, you know, he was an off-duty cop, and he ended up, you talked about, I mean, if there was a hero involved in that day, it was Payton. And the other thing that stood out to me, again, going back to your book, you had a slew of, you know, photographs of the area, the Discovery building, the bottom floor, that big, huge lobby area. And while all this is going on, there's motorcycles and stand-up, like cardboard cutouts of the guys from Orange County Choppers. It seems like it doesn't. Oh man, you're talking about a hostage situation. The guys you're seeing on TV building bikes, yelling at each other, are standing there in the lobby because it looks like they're actually there in the photo.
And you make a great point. Now, kind of describe the lobby and how the scenario unfolded. The lobby is about 200 feet wide and 80 feet deep. It has glass on three sides. The Alpha side faced the Georgia Avenue side. It had double lobby doors on the Bravo side and glass on the Charlie side as well. And the ceiling was probably 20, 30 feet high, and you had three concrete pillars that were evenly spaced. Now, the lobby is much like a museum. Marble floors, there's a skeleton of a T-Rex, and there are artifacts suspended from the ceiling, and cardboard cutouts of the guys from American Chopper. And that's kind of what the layout of the lobby is. So on September 1st, 2010, James Lee, an Asian male in his early 40s, he comes in the lobby. He's pushing a cart. And on that cart is an Alice pack that contains a PBID, Person Born Improvised Explosive Device. He comes into the lobby, displays a handgun, fires several shots in the air, and takes the security guard, Fisher, hostage. Fisher's 37 years old and prior military. At that point, Lee starts to don his Alice pack with the PBID and goes through the process of arming his device. There's a process he has to go through to arm it. As he's arming his device, a second hostage comes through the double lobby doors. He prones that hostage out at gunpoint. Then he goes back to arming his device again. And as he does that, a third hostage comes in who he prones out at gunpoint. So ultimately, he ends up with three hostages, and he's isolated to the lobby area. On the back side of the lobby are two corridors that feed to the rest of the building. Early on, Ed Payden, in conjunction with other responding units, covertly, out of sight of the suspect, sealed off that back area. So ultimately, what we ended up was with a suspect in the lobby with three hostages and his PBID. And we had bomb techs who were giving us assessments of the PBID.
Yeah, you guys had, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but you had some eyes on the floor there. And also, I remember reading in the book that one of the hostages, I think he had a rolling briefcase, and at the time, during your initial assessment, it wasn't clear if that was part of Lee's bomb-making stuff, or was that part of, you know, an innocent guy just pushing his briefcase. Is that correct?
You make a great point. First, let's talk about the security office. There are two corridors coming off the back of the lobby, and we designate them the Delta 1 and Delta 2 corridor. The Delta 1 corridor was the one that was in closest proximity to where Lee was at the security desk. Significance of the other corridor, the Delta 2, there was a security office in there. And in that security office were cameras, so we could get real-time intel, study the suspect, study device and the hostages and so forth. Now, this had all the appearance of being a planned event from what Lee had done, because he had other items on the cart as well. And we know that common practice in planned events are secondary devices. A fear that I had was that maybe some of these other items contained a time device, which would have meant that with every passing moment, we're getting closer to the moment of detonation. When the second hostage came into the lobby, he had a rolling briefcase, and that was now left unattended. Now, I don't like the idea of anything being unattended in a planned incident. And while this guy had all the appearance of being a true hostage, we had a special protocol for dealing with him because we kind of saw him as a wild card. While I was 99.9% sure he was, in fact, a true hostage, we didn't want to take any risk factors. So the fact that we had another unattended item gave us a measure of concern.
Yeah, and you know, you guys talked about that in your book, and you know, I mean, you're going through all your protocols, and then you develop a what do you call it?
Wild card.
Yeah, well, you had the wild card, but you also were developing a deliberate assault plan and an emergency assault plan in case something happened before you were, prepared to go in or he escalated the situation. So it's a pretty fluid situation. You know, you're dealing with a suspect who's obviously, I remember, again, reading in the book, where the hostage negotiator was trying to kill him, and he was extremely upset. And it, at that time, you guys weren't sure he would be able to be talked down.
Yeah, we actually had four plans in place. Our preference was surrender, specific plan for how that would occur. We wanted to do a sniper option if we went to a tactical resolution. Obviously, sniper shot is a good thing. Mm-hmm. Fire distance from target with explosive device is great. But ultimately, our sniper option from the outside is eliminated for a number of reasons, which I can talk about if you choose in a moment. And then the other options were a deliberate assault and an emergency assault.
Yeah, and the sniper option, again, it came down to some of the equipment because the optics didn't give police. Go ahead. Yeah.
Actually, it was we're talking about the sniper shot from the outside in. And in the perfect world, the glass at Discovery was thought to be hurricane glass, which is impact resistant. And my understanding is that's a laminate with two other glasses bonded in a protective cover. And with a .308 caliber rifle, which is what we had, it is my understanding that it can impact, once glass is breached, the flight of the path can be impacted by that. In addition, because this place was like a museum, you had all these artifacts hanging from the ceiling, which also could affect the flight of the bullet. In the perfect world, when a sniper takes a shot, we'd like the suspect to be 3 to 5 feet on the other side of the glass. Depending upon which sniper team we had take the shot, we had three teams out. Once the round breached glass, it had to travel an additional 52 to 75 feet to reach its target. And of our three sniper teams, ideally, we want them to have a straight-on shot to the target. But two of the three teams had poor angle of glass, and their positioning was necessary because I told our sniper teams, I want a team on the Alpha and Charlie side in case the suspect tries to breach glass and break the perimeter, they'll be in position to take him out. The only team that had a straight-on shot from the 9 o'clock position had to shoot through the double glass lobby doors. So for all these reasons, collectively, a sniper shot from the outside was taken out of our options, so to speak.
Right, and then you talked about there was a possibility of an interior sniper shot. And that's where I mistakenly talked about, your Leopold scopes kind of, I would say, yeah, your field of vision at that point is pretty limited with the Leopold scope at that shorter distance.
And you're spot on there. The issue for us was that it was only be like a 30, 40 foot shot, and the hostages would be looking back at us from the Delta One corridor where we took that shot. And the concern was, even at a minimum setting, the only thing the sniper would have is the head of the suspect. And if this hostage reacted and moved laterally, our fear was that the shooter would not be able to pick this up in time, and we didn't want something bad to happen. So from that end, we opted to take the interior sniper shot off and thought that our M4s would be sufficient in dropping the suspect.
Right, and then this entire scenario from start to finish only took about, two, 3 hours, and then it turned out that the hostages kind of drove the train, so to speak, by, I guess, making a run for it, and that kind of forced your hand to, I guess, take your emergency option, assault plan option. Right?
You're spot on. What happened was they were giving hand signals, and ultimately they made a break to try to run and get away. So we ended up doing an emergency assault, and during the emergency assault, we were able to eliminate the suspect as he's trying to detonate device and chase the suspects with his handgun. And ultimately, we rescued three hostages unharmed, no police casualties, and safe evacuation of 1,900 employees and 50 kids from a daycare center in the building that day.
And it was amazing because he, again, going back to the book, he had an emergency like safety in his hand that he had removed. So at that time, he could have actually detonated this device, which turned out to be a live one. I remember hearing on the news when all this unfolded, they weren't sure if he had an actual device or it was one of those fake ones that some people, God knows why would they do that, but he actually had an actual device that would have caused a ton of damage.
It was
inside that lobby.
He had four IEDs, four improvised Siri devices that were filled with four yellow tanks filled with map gas. He had a red oxygen tank in the middle, which would enhance the thermal effect of the map gas. Map gas can reach 5,300 degrees when it's enhanced with oxygen. In addition, he had a pipe bomb on his right leg, the equivalent of a military fragmentation grenade that caused death and injury to those within a 12-meter radius. These were all wired in sequence to essentially go off as one device. And if they had, it would have been catastrophic for everybody in that lobby area.
Right. And, it's amazing that it didn't go off. But you also talked about when he took the hostages, it might have interrupted his sequence of arming those. Is that what it turned out to be the case?
In a nutshell, God was on our side that day. Because what happened is his firing device was what's called a dead man switch. It was release activated, meaning that if he let go of it and it released, his devices would go off. And he had a pause box safety that he could insert into this dead man to prevent it from going off. When we did the emergency assault, the pause box safety was out of the firing device. So by all accounts, the device should have gone off. So the reason that device did not go off that day was, if you remember early on, when he took the first hostage, he started to go through the process of arming his device. He got interrupted when a second hostage came through the double lobby doors. Then he goes back to arming the device again when a third hostage comes in. When the third hostage came in, it interrupted him, and he failed to do the last sequence, which was to throw the power switch. If he had thrown the power switch, which he still could have done while he was pursuing the suspects, that device would have gone off and been catastrophic for everybody. But fortunately, he was a proficient bomb maker. Because we actually, a search warrant was executed at his house the following day, and they found a thumb drive. And on that thumb drive, it shows him testing his device in a wood area. And the thing is, successful would have been catastrophic if it had gone off. And he had come there to die that day because he had entered on his Outlook calendar in August, early August, September 1st, the final day. So he had come to Discovery that day to die. And the FBI ultimately determined that he was a lone wolf domestic terrorist, the first suicide bomber with hostages in the United States. And fortunately for us, things played out in a positive way, but I have no illusions that the outcome of this could have been very different.
That was the date of September 1st of any significance, or did he just pick that out of the blue?
I don't know that it had any significance. I think he might have just picked it out of the blue, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I mean, that was because, again, going back to your book, I was reading all this and I was wondering why, because it said September 1st was, the final day. And, I was trying to come up with a scenario where what would be significant for September 1st, but I couldn't come up with anything. I didn't know if it was just something that you didn't mention in the book or it just something he picked out of the blue with that, but it's amazing that all that happened and no one other than the suspect was hurt that day.
We're fortunate no casualties. And what was kind of frustrating, as you probably saw in the book, is that we had an opportunity to do deliberate assault. We had an opportunity at the 2-hour mark to do the assault with the pause box safety in place, knowing that the device would not go off. But there were some issues that kind of fell through on the command side from my perspective that we should have gone, we didn't go.
Right. There was, wasn't it some worry that, if the device was somehow, detonated, that it would harm people through the upstairs or the
You're correct.
The walls through the, yeah.
demand was concerned, the best estimate from the bomb techs on scene, I can tell you every best estimate they gave us that day was spot on, was that if the device went off, it would kill or seriously injure everybody in the lobby, but it would not travel up to the floors. It would not compromise the integrity of the building. Command staff was concerned that maybe the bomb tech's estimation was off, and if so, what if it traveled up to the floors, injured others, or compromised the integrity of the building? So for those reasons, they wanted to play it safe, and we were told to stand down at what I perceived as a moment of opportunity.
Now I want to get to probably a little bit uncomfortable part for you, and that's when you got sick. You've been a SWAT team member for a long time, and all of a sudden, all the things that you've been training to do for all these years, you're finding them more difficult to do. And, you know, you're sore at night. You're thinking because, you know, sleeping with ice bags, I saw in your book, where you're just thinking it's, you know, the price you pay for being in that type of a unit. Can you explain to our listeners how all that unfolded and, you know, some of the difficult times that you went through with that?
In SWAT, every 3 months we're required to take a physical training test. If you don't pass that test, then you're no longer qualified for SWAT. One of the things in the test is a 3-mile run, which must be done in under 26 minutes. Now, at age 52, I was running in 2030. Running had never been an issue for me. And suddenly, over the last year, my legs felt like lead every time I ran, and I had difficulty breathing and so forth. And unknown to me, that's because I had a very rare cancer, and cardiac amyloidosis, where the walls of my heart were becoming very thick and making it difficult to breathe. So for these reasons, you know, I went and sought medical help because it was clear to me that I wasn't able to pass the SWAT test anymore, which was SWAT was my passion, and I needed to do something about it. And ultimately, I was diagnosed in 2012 with multiple myeloma cancer, which is a blood cancer that affects the immune system, and cardiac amyloidosis. The amyloidosis was far more problematic than the cancer itself, because that was the one that was really going to, from my perspective, take me out right off the bat. So what I had to do was develop how I was going to survive these diseases. And the name of my book, Failure's Not an Option, has two meanings. First meaning applies to SWAT. One, I told you I was a operator, team leader, and commander. And when I became commander, there were three things I always asked the men, and they delivered every time. You never complain, you never quit, and failure is not an option as it relates to mission. So you cannot fail in your mission ever. So I took that same perspective towards my diseases. I said, I will never complain, I will never quit, and failure is not an option as it relates to my mission. And my mission is to survive. So I have no choice but to survive based on my SWAT training.
Yeah, and you talked about in the book where, you know, the prognosis for this wasn't very promising whatsoever. I mean, that has to be for somebody like yourself, who's at the tip of the spear and you're in tremendous physical condition, and then to be told that you have less than 2 years, that's got to be it.
I'm sorry. When I was diagnosed,
it's gotta be
for the cancer, the average survival rate was 3 to 4 years. For undiagnosed amyloidosis, which I had, the average survival rate was 8 months. And I had survived 2 years before it was determined what I had. Through no fault of my doctors, because I had a very rare disease. But when you're faced with the type of prognosis that I had, you basically have a choice. You can wait to die or choose to live. And I chose to live. It's very simple. I believe every man is his own legacy. It matters not what happened to those before me. And I told my doctors from day one, I will survive this, and I intend to.
And now it's been, 12 years? So, and now you're in remission as well, are you not?
Yeah, I've achieved remission. And I was looking at some stats. Stats have changed because obviously, as long as you survive, through novel research and clinical studies, things improve. Now the average life expectancy for the cancer at 10 years is 10%. And I've survived beyond 10 years. The average life expectancy at 10 years for the cardiac amyloidosis is 4.7%. But, you know, I just keep trying to use that same SWOT attitude and mindset to keep pushing forward.
And we talked offline before we started the recording, and having your SWAT team members nearby, having your wife, who's also a police officer, having that team around you and that positive mental attitude with those people has to be a tremendous help for you going through the tough time.
Absolutely amazing. And I'll tell you what really struck me. The first day I went for my chemo treatment, I show up at the doctor's office. And I walk into the office. My entire SWAT team is there. And then some executive officers, my wife, and some other people. So I was like, my gosh, there's probably 30 people inside there. So they only allow four back into the treatment area. So I go back. So I'm there for about an hour. And I come back out. And every one of them is still there waiting, providing support. And that moment told me right there that these guys are my brothers for life, period. And my counterpart, the other commander of the SWAT team with me, Brian Dillman, he set up a rotation so that every time I had chemo treatment, three or four SWAT officers were there, and they stayed for the entire duration of my treatment. And having that type of support from your team is absolutely unbelievable in terms of the strength and motivation it gives you.
Yeah, that's great stuff. And, you know, it's amazing that you've been able to keep your positive mental outlook on things, and you're beating the odds now, and you get to watch your son grow up.
Oh, no doubt. He was a motivation. He was 10 years old when I was diagnosed, and you make a great point. You know, I wanted to see him in his early achievements. I want to see him his driver's license. I want to see him his first job. I want to see him graduate from high school. And fortunately, by the grace of God, you know, I've had those things happen.
Well, again, we want to thank you. Thank you for your service to our country. Thank you for taking the time today with us. I know, you know, we asked you to talk a lot, and with the disease that you're still fighting, it impacts your wind a little bit, but we really appreciate all that. And the book was fantastic. It's a great read. We encourage all of our listeners to go out there and check it out. Failure is not an option. The DC snipers take down Discovery Building, Suicide Bomber, Hostage Rescue, and Surviving Terminal Diseases by Jeff Nice, along with Richard Ziegfeld, who you talked about at length in your book, your editor, who you're very, very close with, who's now passed away. We want to thank you once again for taking the time with us. But before we let you go, I have to read our ad one more time for our sponsor. And again, have you ever talked about a time when you searched for something online that you didn't really want others knowing about? I know most of you are probably thinking, why don't you just use incognito mode? Let me tell you something. Incognito mode doesn't hide your online activity. It doesn't matter what mode you use or how many times you clear your browsing history. Your internet service provider can see every single website you've ever visited. That's why when we're at home, we never go online without using ExpressVPN. It doesn't matter if you get your internet from Verizon, Comcast, Charter, any of the other local ISP offerings. ISPs in the U.S. can legally sell your information to ad companies. ExpressVPN is an app that reroutes your internet connection through their secure service so your ISP can't see the site you visit. ExpressVPN also keeps all your information secure by encrypting 100% of your data with the most powerful encryption available. Most of the time, you won't even realize you have it on. It runs seamlessly in the background and is very, very easy to use. All you have to do is tap one button and boom, you're protected. ExpressVPN is available on all your devices, phones, computers, even your smart TV. So there's no excuse for you not to be using it. Protect your online activity today with a VPN rated number one by CNET and Wired. Visit our exclusive link, expressvpn.com/softrep, and you can get an extra 3 months free on a one-year package. That's expressvpn.com/softrep. ExpressVPN.com/softrep to learn more. Before we go, I also wanted to mention, did you want to get SoftRep on your phone? You can download our free app to get easy access to all of our articles, podcasts, peer reviews, all perfectly formatted to your device. Please subscribe to SoftRep.com to get access to all of our library of ebooks and our exclusive team room forums and content. It's available on all Apple and Android devices. So we want to thank all of our listeners today for joining us. We especially want to thank you, Jeff, for joining us today. It's been a pleasure. The book I was very entertained by. It's a really fast read once you get into it, because once you start, you don't want to put it down. And again, thank you for all your service for somebody who's at the tip of the spear, you know, in the law enforcement type world. Somebody was on probably 4,500, you know, takedowns or barricades. We appreciate your service. And once again, God bless and take care. And we hope to have you back when you write your next book.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
There's two kinds of people in the world. People who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Health Aid Kombucha.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.